From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The number of people who identify as Christian is declining, and a new category of nuns, meaning nothing in particular, agnostic and atheist, is growing. That's according to a study by the Pew Research Center from 2015 called the American Religious Landscape Study. If the current trend stays the course, according to Pew, American society is likely to grow less religious, even if today's adults maintain their current level of commitment. So what do these changing religious views tell us about our culture and our definition of community? What does it say about the value Americans place on spirituality? And how have ideas around what that even means changed? What are the repercussions of losing our religion, if any? Most importantly, if organized religion is on the decline, what is taking its place? Here to help us answer these questions through the lens of Southeastern North Carolinians and the Cape Fear region, Cheryl M. Walker is pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Wilmington. Cheryl M. Walker, welcome to Coastline.
Well, thank you, Rachel.
Daniel Lewis is pastor of First Presbyterian Church in downtown Wilmington. Daniel Lewis, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
And Andrew Coates is an instructor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where he studies the history of religion in America in the early 20th century. Welcome, Andrew Coates.
Hi, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Have you made a conscious decision to change your childhood faith practice? Have you returned to a religious institution after being raised by agnostic parents? Or have you abandoned a religious culture you found wanting in some way? Tell us about why you practice or why you don't. And if you're not a member of a religious community, where do you find the experience of community? You can call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Andrew Coates of UNCW, what do studies such as the Pew Research Study that corroborate this trend of Americans moving away from organized religion really tell us about Americans? Is this relinquishing of religious affiliation the same thing as moving towards secularism and away from spirituality?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say, according to the Pew data, probably not. This is not a sign necessarily of increasing secularism. The category of people that is growing, according to Pew, are these folks that identify as nothing in particular. And that's a little bit different than someone who is, say, aggressively secular or atheist. And in fact, it's a big open question for scholars right now, who actually are these folks that call themselves religiously unaffiliated? What are their religious interests, if any, and how do they do what they do if they aren't interested in religion? Are they interested in something else? And frankly, it's a big open question because some of the data seems to suggest that a good portion of people who don't identify with any religion in particular still consider themselves to be somewhat or at least partly religious. Which is odd in its own way, but that's what the data is showing. So, yeah.
Cheryl M. Walker of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Wilmington. For those folks who aren't familiar with Unitarian Universalists, could you just sort of explain what your church believes, what your congregation comes together for?
I describe us as communities of faithful people working to build a better world while unagreed on the most essential issues of faith.
And what does so does that mean you don't ascribe to a particular tenet of theology?
That's correct. So on any given Sunday, if you're sitting in a pew in one of our congregations, on your left could be a person who would say that they tried to live the path of the Buddha. On the right is someone who would say, no, for me, Jesus is central. Behind you is someone who says, I am a religious humanist. In front of you is probably someone saying, I'm not sure.
Now, in light of that idea of inclusiveness and the lack of adherence to any particular theology, it sounds like a practice of spirituality. It would seem that based on this Pew Research study, your congregation would be growing. Is Wilmington strange? Is it growing? What's happening?
No, because that same group of people, I mean, we have studied the Pew study inside out. They're saying we're not interested in any organized religion. So we're a denomination. We are a particular faith community. We get some of them if we start doing things outside of traditional church. They're not interested in sitting in a pew.
So they're not interested in the Sunday morning Christian practice.
That group is pretty much not interested in that. But if you bring people together for a cause, they are very interested in causes. They will come as community for a shared purpose and find they have shared values. So when someone walks into one of our congregations, we assume that they have shared values, but not necessarily always shared purposes. Many of the spiritual, non-religious, the nuns are very much involved in their communities for purpose, but not for value.
Daniel Lewis of First Yes. Presbyterian Church in Wilmington, when you look at this trend that has been articulated by this Pew study, what does it mean for First Presbyterian Church, which is traditionally a very conservative congregation and has been kind of one of the pillars of the religious community, I think that's fair to say, in Wilmington over the years?
Sure. What do these trends mean for us? Well, they're challenging, and we face them every day. As Reverend Walker has said, we're familiar with the trends, and we're thinking about what they mean for us and for our faith practice. And
are you seeing a diminishing congregation or diminishing membership?
Well, I'd say that the new growing is holding steady, and I'm new to this congregation, and we're holding pretty steady. So we're excited about where we are in this church. But certainly nationally, the Presbyterian Church USA is declining, like other mainline denominations. And so this is a serious issue, but it's not particularly new. It's generations old, and we've been noting this for a while. And I think some of the explanations that are bandied about sometimes end up sounding a little bit thin and not comporting with what actually is happening on the ground. So, for instance, I find that the people who do wander into our congregation for one reason or another of a Sunday morning or another event that our church sponsors, find it to be a place far more welcoming and inviting than what they envisioned. And perhaps I won't pick any boogeyman, but for some reason the picture of church that has been painted over the years is of a place that stands primarily for bigotry and hatred and exclusion. And again, it's probably not good to try to pinpoint exactly where that came from, but it did come from that. Maybe we've lost our faith leaders on a national scale that we used to have who could speak a different kind, a more open and welcoming and grace-centered gospel. And people are surprised to find that that exists in our world. And oh my goodness, I wasn't made to feel like an outcast because I'm different coming into church. And so we're seeing more of that, and it's encouraging to me.
Are you seeing a need then to kind of expand the idea of diversity within your congregation?
Oh, yes, yes.
How do you do that? Because that is one of the real illustrators of the extreme racial segregation that exists in the Cape Fear region. Sunday morning, that's where you see it.
Right. Right, Dr. King called it the most segregated hour.
11 a.m.
on Sunday morning, and that remains the case. And on a personal level, I'll tell you, it's what remains the case for us in a big way. But there are congregations all over this country that are breaking down those barriers, and we aim to be one of them. But it is an uphill climb, and particularly in this place, our history of racial strife and violence and oppression. It plays a huge role, and it's part of the sense of my own personal call to this place was to begin working on those issues, and I feel a deep sense of God's call for that.
Cheryl M. Walker.
So religion is a cultural expression. We don't have a single religion, and even within different theologies, how people do religion and do church is a cultural expression. We don't have a shared American culture. So in order to really diversify culturally, you have to start building what does not exist in this country, which is a new culture, a new shared culture of bringing in people from all different backgrounds and not just giving lip service to their culture. Oh, it's Martin Luther King weekend. I guess we'll all talk about racism.
Right.
Oh, it's Black History Month. Let's get a guest black preacher. Yeah. So we have to build a new culture.
Interesting observation. And when we come back, Andrew Coates from UNCW, I want to hear from you about how we've arrived at this point in history, where we've come from. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're exploring the American trend away from organized religion and looking at the meaning of community. Tell us about your experience building community, whether within the walls of a religious institution or outside of it. You can call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're exploring the changing definition and even the source of community for many Americans. Since 2015, when the Pew Research Center published a study showing a solid American trend away from religious affiliation, people have been seeking both spirituality and community in other ways. Today, we have two faith leaders and one historian with us to answer your questions about this trend. Andrew Coates is a UNCW instructor in the Philosophy and Religion Department. Daniel Lewis is pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Wilmington, and Cheryl M. Walker is pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, also in Wilmington. And we want to hear from you about your spiritual practice and or your source of community. How do you find those things if not part of a church or a temple or a mosque? Have you chosen as an adult to join a congregation? Tell us why during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And before we get to a couple of calls and emails, Andrew Coates with UNCW, what was the American religious landscape like at the beginning of this country and then, you know, taking a snapshot of the early 20th century? Mm-hmm. What did it look like and how is it so different from today?
Sure. So one thing that we have to reckon with when we study the history of religion in America is that there has always been, always, and it is still the case today, that there is a Protestant majority in this country. It's undeniably true. The vast majority of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence were Protestants. There were only three Catholics that signed that document. And Protestants have always had, in some way, shape, or form, some kind of at least numerical dominance in America. I think one of the shifts that we're seeing today is that people who were maybe more nominally affiliated with Protestantism before, that is, people who very infrequently participated in Protestantism, used to call themselves Christians. And that was really important to their sense of identity, their sense of belonging to a community, right? People of my grandparents' generation, my grandmother almost never darkened the door of a church, but she considered herself a Methodist to the day she died. Whereas today, I think what we're seeing is people are less interested in adopting that kind of identification for themselves.
Tell us about your grandmother's identification. Why was that Methodist affiliation so important to her if she didn't go to church regularly?
You know what? I think it was just a thing in that generation. I mean, being part of a community meant you went to church somewhere, or at least you considered yourself a part of the Christian community. Frankly, I think it also ties into notions of whiteness and what it means to be a white American. You identify with this church and not that other church. It was just a generational thing. I mean, to conduct business, you had to be, or were more likely to be able to do business if you were both members of similar kinds of churches, right? So I think back in the day, that's just the way things were done. Whereas now, we have different kinds of identifications for ourselves. We like to associate ourselves with different kinds of markers, and we don't like labels necessarily as much.
Daniel Lewis.
Andrew, I wonder, isn't it also, couldn't speak for your grandmother, but I wonder if for people of that generation, it's also a sense of rootedness because of the first thing that you said about that, whatever that founding sense of our nation and its Protestant heritage with all of its warts and all, but the claiming of that identity, I wonder if that was a tie to the past and a rootedness in a tradition that grounded a person beyond him or herself, tied them to the generations going back, and that seems to be always an important thing for people, I find, and yet a thing that is threatened and changing in our modern world, where we're thinking of ourselves maybe more as free and autonomous and untethered from any particular history or tradition.
Well, let's pinpoint this trend for a second, because this Pew Research study that we've referred to a few mm-hmm. times was published in 2015. Daniel Lewis of First Presbyterian Church, you've alluded to the fact that you've seen this within the church for generations. And Andrew Coates, you're saying that the change really started with the generation of your grandmother, which would be roughly around what time period?
That she was born in the 30s. The changes that are happening, I think, sociologically, have been happening since about the 1960s. That's when we see this marked increase in people who identify themselves as nothing in particular. And what I was pointing to is a kind of small technical detail, I guess, in that Pew study, which is the group that's most likely to consider themselves religiously unaffiliated are people who seldom or never participate in religious services.
Cheryl M. Walker.
It's also a reflection, I think, of a larger cultural trend. John Dornhauer, the general minister of the United Church of Christ, told the story of his grandfather bought a Buick and then always bought a Buick. Every car he bought after that was a Buick. But his father first bought a Buick because his father told him to buy a Buick, but then switched. And now John would, whatever car fit his need. So there isn't that same duty and loyalty to a brand. That means religion too, you know. So the religion of the faith of your father is not necessarily going to be yours.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of questions that Americans have around the importance of organized religion. And answering your questions on this Wednesday, Andrew Coates, an instructor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, Cheryl M. Walker, pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Wilmington, and Daniel Lewis, pastor of First Presbyterian Church in downtown Wilmington. You can give us a call during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Penelope, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I had two comments. The first one, kind of in the historical perspective, when I was living in Memphis in the 70s, I met Lyle Schauer, who was a church consultant, and he said that evangelical Christianity was going to be the thing of the future. This is in the mid-70s. And at the time, I was involved with a very liberal Methodist church that was very involved with the civil rights movement, and I was like, I can't believe that evangelicalism is going to take over. But, of course, it did. So that was quite a shock to me, but I always remembered what he had predicted. The other thing I wanted to comment on is that for the last 25 years, I've been an ordained interfaith minister, primarily doing wedding ceremonies. And I find that the people that come to me don't want a traditional religious ceremony, but they often want some religious elements in their ceremony, such as prayers or blessings and that kind of thing, sometimes even scripture. And those same people will come back to me later and after they've had children and want me to do a baby blessing or baptism. They might ask me to do a memorial service for a family member. So they, even though they don't want the traditional religious stuff, they want those spiritual elements in their lives. So those are my two comments.
Penelope, thank you so much for those observations. Andrew Coates, you were nodding vigorously during some of Penelope's observations about the rise of evangelical Christianity that was predicted in the 1970s. Is that something that we've been able to document?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, culturally, at least the mid-70s were kind of the heyday of evangelicalism. 1976, I think, Time magazine proclaimed the year of the evangelical. This is when Jimmy Carter was first coming to power, and he called himself a born-again Christian. And at first, a lot of, you know, mainstream American culture was baffled at what this meant. And then by 1980, it had become very clear who evangelicals were and what they were all about. So that's kind of part of why I was nodding vigorously. And then also thinking about what the caller was saying about how religion structures these sort of pivotal moments in people's lives. It kind of tells you what you're supposed to do when you get married, or tells you what you're supposed to do when you have a baby. So even for folks that don't consider themselves personally religious because of what they think in their heads, it's still really important for a lot of these unaffiliated Americans to do the things that they think they ought to do at these pivotal points in your life. So, like, let me get super personal again because it's what I've been doing. my wife and I, right, neither of us really consider ourselves religiously affiliated in any way. But when we got married, we knew that we were going to basically have a Christian wedding because that's what our families wanted. And, you know, weddings are mostly about your family. It's about saying we're bringing two families together and here's how we're going to do that. I mean, certainly, right, both of us coming from backgrounds that were Protestant and Christian, we weren't going to have a Catholic wedding and we weren't going to have a Jewish wedding or something. That's not what people are supposed to do in our community. Right?
But it had to be somehow religiously anchored for you. It had to be connected to some form of spirituality. It couldn't just be a secular wedding.
You know, I think we would have been fine with a secular wedding, but we know that our families would have had issues with that. And you know, we care about our families. And so we wanted to do the things that they would say this was a real wedding.
Cheryl M. Walker, when people come to your church, which, as we've established earlier, doesn't have a particular adherence to any particular theological tenet, what do you think they get from that? What are they seeking when they come to the Unitarian Universalist congregation?
Well, we don't have any theological tests. We are very strong and strict about the principles we uphold. So it's not as if we are willy-nilly about our moral fiber. We're very clear about where we stand. But one of the things that people are looking for is a place to explore. I teach a class every, at least once a year, called This I Believe. And in it, we spend 5 weeks exploring, well, what do you believe? what's your credo statement? What do you give your heart to? It's the one class that I teach that I have to put a limit on, because otherwise I'd have 50 people every single time. Because people are coming because they want to ask those questions and they want to have answers that fit their lives, but they don't want answers given to them.
That's an interesting observation. Daniel Lewis of First Presbyterian Church.
I want to respond to both to what Dr. Coates and Reverend Walker said, and say that this is anecdotal. I can't remember the study that I'm thinking of here, but there's also been some interesting research showing that the churches and communities growing these days, at least some of them, are not doing so by merely lowering the bar either of their confessional standards or of how they operate in worship and what they ask of people to be involved, but in fact raise them and make them more strict. And so I'm thinking of a wedding or a baptism that comes up a lot in our church, where there's some sort of a cultural expectation, maybe on the part of, say, grandparents who expect to see a grandchild baptized, but the parents themselves, they're less concerned about that. And so I find that what I end up doing, which can end up having me take some heat, really, is instead of simply accommodating the wish of the grandparents because that's born of some cultural habit, I say I want to speak to the parents, and I'm saying what we're doing here is about a lifelong commitment to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And if that's not something that you feel comfortable answering those questions, yes, I will, then this is not for you. And that is not by way of exclusion or putting up some barrier. It protects the integrity of what we're trying to do, and in fact gets us back to our Christian roots, which from the beginning were a bit countercultural. I'm talking about the very beginning of the Christian faith, not so much tied up in just what was the done thing.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of the changing role of organized religion in American lives and how that's playing out here in the Cape Fear region in a couple of congregations. We want to hear from you during this live Wednesday discussion. How do you practice your faith, if you have one? And how do you practice and find community? You can give us a call during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Daniel Lewis, Don writes, in consideration of younger generations being accepting and tolerant of alternative lifestyles, are religious groups or leaders changing views, and I'm asking you specifically about First Presbyterian here, changing views on the acceptability of including people who identify with the LGBTQ community into their groups?
Question is, are we changing on that?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes, I think so. It's an ongoing conversation in our congregation, which is large and diverse as far as its opinions about these things. But we have a ministry started within our church called Open Arms that exists to welcome and affirm the LGBTQ community. And so that's a group within our church. It's strong and thriving and working hard to make sure that we're more welcoming and diverse moving forward. But again, it's a large congregation, and it's an ongoing conversation.
How do you find that balance? You talk about keeping the integrity intact of your particular version of theology. How do you find that balance between adjusting to new cultural norms that emerge versus sticking to biblical principles? Because a lot of people would argue, and I think before your time, Daniel Lewis, at First Presbyterian Church, there was a pretty public division.
Yes.
When there was a request to have a same-sex marriage ceremony there, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it tore that church apart along
sure.
those lines. So,
sure.
So where's the church now, and how do you justify the new position?
Well, I'd say, so we are a church that is governed by a board of elders elected by the congregation, people who are constantly turning over. And so it's a moving target there, and so it's an ongoing conversation. And so I think the time that you're referring to, our governing board, that is our board of elders, made that decision that a blessing service was appropriate and okay, and they weren't ready to do a same-sex marriage. Now, that was the governing board at that time, and that decision still stands, and it will continue on into the future, that conversation.
Even though the Supreme Court has ruled that it's now a civil right, and it's considered...
The right to be married, but not the right to be married in any particular church. I mean, the church has to wrestle with that theologically rather than, in a civil way. So, but I think along the larger issue, that your first part of your question is a great one, and the answer is on a case-by-case basis. Every time it is hard, because the situation that Andrew describes, say, of a wedding or a baptism or any other religious observance that seems to be that Christ-haunted thing, that I think it was Flannery O'Connor that said that, where there's this cultural expectation, and is the church going to abide by that and accommodate it, or is it going to hold the line? It can be a window, it can be a door through which people find their way back into faith. And so we don't want to slam that door, but at the same time, we want to hold up an authentic version of what it means to be a disciple, and that's the balance that we're working towards.
We have an email from Jim who writes, as an unapologetic atheist for the past 30 years, I've had to find my community in various places, book clubs, yoga classes, and on occasion, the free thought community. While I do not understand the need for God, I do understand the need for fellowship and community. I try to support church groups that do social justice and community charitable work when I can. Cheryl M. Walker, we're about to go to break.
You'd fit right in. You would not be alone.
When we come back, I want to hear from all of you about the intersection of religion and politics and what the difference is between politics and social activism. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of organized religion in 2018. We'd like to hear about how you find community in the Cape Fear region. Call us during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. Email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're finding out today why some people are struggling more with organized religion and what, if anything, is taking the place of that in people's lives. With us on this Wednesday, Daniel Lewis, pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Wilmington, Cheryl M. Walker, pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, also in Wilmington, that's always a mouthful, and Andrew Coates, UNCW instructor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion. This is the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your question in. Tell us about your source of community, why you're part of an organized religious congregation or not. You can call us during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Before we went to break, Pastor Daniel Lewis of First Presbyterian Church was talking about how to walk that line and how your church walks that line with the Board of Elders between changing cultural norms and sticking with biblical principles. Cheryl M. Walker of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, how do you stay separated from politics while at the same time advocating certain types of social, possibly cultural activism? Or is there a separation there?
I think there's a false separation to some extent. So every law is a moral decision. Will I spend money on war or money on the poor? Those are moral decisions. So if one of our purposes in our religious communities is to give someone a moral foundation, then I'm not sure how you don't vote your morality. You should say, when you go into the booth, So how does this, voting for this person or this person, also uphold the faith I have? So our very first principle of Unitarian Universalism is a respect for the dignity and worth of every person. So how do you vote for someone who does not do that? So this, there's in some ways a falseness between politics and a false gap between politics and religion. At the same time, there is a true separation of the church and the state. The church shall not dictate to the state, nor the state dictate to the church. And I think we sometimes conflate those two when they shouldn't be.
Is there an issue then? President Donald Trump has said multiple times that he'd like to see the Johnson Amendment repealed, which would remove what you're calling that false separation between politics and what is talked about in your case on Sunday mornings in church. Daniel Lewis, a First Presbyterian, I see you shaking your head.
Well, I'm shaking my head. I think I would clarify and tell me, Reverend Walker, if you'd agree. I think she and I would see very much eye to eye on this. I agree with everything she just said. And our faith drives us into the public sphere. It absolutely needs to do that. There is no faith that is not lived out in the public sphere. And true, every public policy decision is at root a moral decision. And so I believe the proposed legislation relates to the Johnson Amendment has to do with whether I can stand up in the pulpit and advocate for a particular candidate. And I still believe that ought to be maintained, that amendment, and I ought not to do that because there are a thousand reasons, some of them theological, that I don't believe any particular candidate is without sin or fault. But what I can do at any given Sunday and will do is speak about particular issues mm-hmm. and what the gospel calls us to. And I absolutely must and call our people to faithfulness around those issues, not around particular candidates.
Can you give us an example of one of those issues?
Oh, goodness. I mean, Jesus said, whenever you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. And so those in our community who don't have enough to eat or a roof over their heads or clothing, there are public policy decisions that affect who has and who does not, and I believe that part of what I do is drive people out into the world to address those things in the public sphere.
That's exactly right, and this is where I think Cheryl M. Walker, you're referring to this false separation between those ideas.
Absolutely.
If a candidate is advocating for certain public policy positions, then does it become just a question of semantics when you're saying, well, I'm not saying the name, but, you know, such and such and so and so? I mean, really, is it, you know, this discussion of issues in the world, at practical issues, and how that informs public policy?
You may say semantics, but I think it's important. It is. And there will be times in my own preaching, I think, where people will say, oh, I knew what you were talking about, but you didn't say it. But the distinction is important enough to say the gospel calls us to care about people, the dignity of people, and you work out the implications, but it may be awfully obvious on any particular issue, at least to me, what the implications are.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about the role of organized religion in American life today, and specifically in the Cape Fear region. With us, Daniel Lewis, pastor of First Presbyterian Church in downtown Wilmington, Cheryl M. Walker, pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Wilmington, and Andrew Coates, instructor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. We have a few minutes left to hear from you on this live Wednesday discussion. You can do that two ways, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. We have it looks like Jane is gone. Jane from Wilmington called in and said, I was raised Methodist, married Catholic. However, currently in my family, we have two nuns, one atheist, and she means nuns as in no religious affiliation, not the Catholic one atheist, and I would consider myself spiritual. Do people lose anything by being individualists? We've talked about community a lot here, but what does community really mean? And does that mean the subjugation of the individual self to the larger good, or can those two things go hand in hand? Cheryl M. Walker.
We are a herding species. We are communal. This idea of the solitary figure doesn't work for us as human beings. We come into the world, we are totally dependent upon someone. We can't walk for a whole year. So what you lose when you're not in some sort of community is, who do you call at 3 a.m.? Who will be there with a casserole? Who will drive you to the doctor? Who will laugh with you through the night? Where are those people where you will form deep personal relationships? Another study that came out around the same time as the Pew study was a study on friendships. And 50 years ago, people reported to have 4 to 5 good, close personal friends. That number is down to 1 to 2, and 25% of people, which happened to be the same percentage of people who were not religiously affiliated, reported having 0 close personal friends.
Why do we need to find those relationships in an organized religious setting, Daniel Lewis, that sense of community, that sense of connection? And I'm assuming you think we do, because you, you are the leader of a large local congregation.
Certainly. But I want to make sure that the way that I articulate this is not to heap any sort of blame or make any finger wagging at those who find community in other places. But we think, so rather than any finger wagging, an open door to a community that is rooted in deep tradition, we find that rootedness and that long sense of tradition grounds people in a way that a self-made, self-invented community, whether on the internet or somewhere else, simply can't do.
We have an email from Judson. He writes, I've decided to find community as a musician in local groups that share my interests, such as record stores and art groups. Also, I've found more community in my Zen meditation group and drinking with friends at a bar. I find it hard to also take moral guidance from organized religion when there are so many cover-ups of sexual abuse while criticizing people who are gay. Thank you for weighing in, Judson. Mary writes, I was watching a program on the History Channel in 2008 about primitive religions in South America. During the program, I realized Christianity is just as made up as any other religion. Since then, I've realized there's no one in control of our planet. Nobody's going to save us if we destroy it. I don't need religion to know the difference between right and wrong. I don't need religion for a moral compass. For centuries, Christianity has hijacked morality and burned people at the stake for witchcraft, heresy, and for subscribing to other religions. I will continue to use critical thinking and science in my life, as it's the only life I to live.
Me three, yeah.
And that was Daniel Lewis.
I just felt like that needed to be said. Okay. Me too.
Yeah, science is great.
Doris writes, my husband and I moved to Wilmington 2.5 years ago from New Jersey, did not regularly attend church in New Jersey, but decided to try the most liberal church, Unitarian Universalism, in Wilmington. From the very first Sunday UU service, we found a community of people of shared values and a minister that preaches messages relevant to living our best lives. We never thought we would be churchgoers, but are so grateful to have found a spiritual home in Wilmington.
Thank you.
Alan writes, as a practicing Buddhist, I base my life on the principle that all people are respect-worthy. We all possess unlimited potential expressed as the Buddhist nature, Buddha nature. Once we each awaken to respect for each other, all barriers to peace, happiness, and harmony are broken. For me, being a social activist is being engaged in unearthing the fundamental dignity found in all life. Thank you for that. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how people are finding community, how they're practicing spirituality, as we're watching trends of people being affiliated with organized religion diminishing. I want to bring up another study from 2015, published in the journal Current Biology. It concludes that religiousness is inversely predictive of children's altruism and positively correlated with their punitive tendencies.
Oh, my goodness. Daniel Lewis, I'll let you address this.
You have to answer for that?
To be clear, the more this study is saying, the more religious a family, the less likely the kids are to be altruistic and the more likely the kids are to be punitive. This was a third-party evaluation of nearly 1,200 kids between ages 5 and 12 in six countries, Canada, China, Jordan, Turkey, the USA, and South Africa. What does this tell us about, is this church? Is this extremism? What does it tell us? Cheryl M. Walker, you're...
Did they mean religious or pious?
Well, they said they used the term religiousness.
Yeah, and often we use religious when we really mean pious.
And what does pious mean? How
pious,
is that different?
There is a strict, you know, you will adhere strictly to every rule. And that the rules are central, not the spirit. Whereas I think in being religious, the spirit is central and not the rules. And a lot of it will depend upon that image then that you give of God. Is God judging with strict rules? If that is the image then they get, I could see where they would not be as altruistic.
Daniel Lewis, as pastor of First Presbyterian, do you often find people coming to you who've had negative experiences in church that would kind of produce this kind of thinking?
Sure, all the time. And all I can say, you know, rather than, I mean, my first instinct was to quibble with, you know, how are the terms defined in the study and such, is to say that we're trying week in and week out to cultivate a people of generosity and love for others, and also as part of our spiritual practice, every single Sunday is confession. And I think our nation, not only our church, but our nation needs to learn how to speak of what it does not do well and confess.
There's another interesting study about the effects of organized religion, and Andrew Coates from UNCW, if you could comment on this. This was published by the London School of Economics and Erasmus University Medical Center in the Netherlands, and it concluded joining a religious group can provide more sustained happiness than other social activities. Is that something that you've seen in your studies?
Not really. No, that's surprising to me. I don't know why that would be the case at all. I guess unless people like, you know, consistency, tradition, rules, those sorts of things. I don't know why it would be the case that religious groups would produce more sustained happiness than other kinds of groups, like, say, music or being in a band or going drinking with friends regularly or something. I'm kind of surprised by that finding.
Yeah, that is. I mean, the only thing I could see is that there is a consistency of people.
Mm-hmm.
That in many other groups, people are coming in and out and in and out and in and out, that if you are committed to a particular congregation of whichever ilk, these are people who will see you through the best and worst times of your lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a happiness in knowing that there is that support of this group of people who have been there, will be there continuously. That's the only thing I could think of that would, but that's good news for us.
And, you know, that leads to a column published earlier this month by David Brooks of the New York Times talking about Martin Luther King described segregation and injustice as forces tearing us apart and basically losing our religion. We still don't have a cohesive grounding that binds us together. Daniel Lewis. Final thought in 10 seconds.
Hey, amen, Dr. King, and that's what we're working towards.
That's this edition of Coastline. Cheryl M. Walker, Daniel Lewis, Andrew Coates, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan, who was also our chief engineer today. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.